Right. So I'm going to talk about challenges in protein ligand docking and scoring. And first, I'd like to introduce the virtual screening problem. How does it fit into a computational dock design? And then I'm going to talk about the actual docking algorithm of eHITs, and then a scoring function, and finally some simplified tool as well, and then some results. So just to place it into the context of a dock design problem, what Forbes was talking about is how you can get some idea about the protein structure. Because basically when a dock design problem is faced, we need to have a structure that we can work with, because the idea is that there is a target identified by the biologist that usually the protein could be an RNA or a DNA as well. And then we need to find a small molecule that would bind to it in order to have an effect, a medicinal effect on it. So usually we need to get a structure of that, the three-dimensional structure of that protein, and then use some kind of screening method to go through a large set of candidate possible small molecules that could be possible drugs, and then find something that will bind to that, and then do with some modeling and design modifications to it, synthesize it, evaluate how it binds, and try to improve it and go through a cycle until it gets good enough to go through a biological and clinical testing. So what I'm going to focus on is this step here, what kind of screening methods we can do on the computers. The traditional screening is, of course, that we try out all the molecules, and that was the traditional way of drug discovery, that they just tried it in the lab, and there are high-throughput screening methods where the robots can do this screening quickly. But if you can do it on the computer, that's also cheaper and faster usually. So for this screening, basically, there are two major approaches you can take. One is so-called ligand-based methods, and the other one is the docking. The major difference between the two are summarized in this table. One is the speed. Ligand-based methods are usually much faster. They don't have to work with the large protein structure. Docking methods are slower. The input you require for a ligand-based method, a set of known actives. So basically, you cannot start from scratch. You have to have something where you already know some activities, and you have to try to find some other structures that will also have activities and hopefully better than the ones that you've known. And in the other case, for the docking, we need the 3D protein structure. So we need the structure of that target to be built. And what the output difference is that the ligand-based method typically will give you some similarity measure or just some arbitrary score, while docking method can give you an actual binding energy estimate. Obviously, it's not the real value, it's an estimate, but that's much more useful and can be used to make a decision of which ones to go with further. And in terms of structural output, the ligand-based methods either give you nothing, just say a number of how good a ligand is, or it might give you some overlay information to the known octaves. On the other hand, the docking will give you an actual conformation and pose of that structure, so you can do further studies on it. Now, because of the speed difference that I mentioned, there is a so-called funnel that is often used in actual practical applications in pharmaceutical industries, because what you have is we start out with a huge library of molecules that you can consider, and that if it's an actual available molecules or a corporate database that's it's in the millions, or if it could be a virtual library that you just have some building blocks and simple chemistry, and then you know that you can make a lot of combinations of those, and that could be much bigger even. And then from that we want to go down and find some good lead compounds that we can work with. And one step is to use these fast ligand-based methods or some very simple QSAR. QSAR stands for quantitative structure activity relationship filters or 3D pharmacoform ideas or some simple things that can be done fast. And we use this big set to a much smaller thousands of molecules that are candidates, and then apply docking in that phase. where we can offboard it, to find some hundreds of hits, and then we can do even more expensive calculations, molecular dynamics simulations with quantum mnemonics or molecular mnemonics or free energy perturbations to actually select the final leads that we will work with. So just a little bit more about the ligand-based methods. So there are very simple filters where you just do simple counts of how many hydrogen bond donors and acceptors are there on the molecule, what's the log p value, or what's the molecular weight, and you can set up limits on what's interesting, what is typically good for a drug molecule. And that can already filter out some of the possibilities. Then there is a little bit more complicated, more sophisticated checks like fingerprints, where basically what you are looking at is when you have a ligand like this, okay, we count what type of known functional groups it has. So it has, let's say, this sulfonide group here, and this has this ring, or has an amide there, and then just indicate with simple bits which ones exist. And then we can compare similarities with the existing known active ligands compared to the big database, which ones have similar features. Other methods are 3D pharmacophore match, when we have some information about what would like to, like certain hydrogen bond donors and acceptors, what's the distance between them, those sort of informations can be used also to filter quickly these molecules. And then there are feature tree matching methods which build a graph tree representation of the structures with various features attached to them. And 3D shape matching, try to find similar shape ligands to the active ones, or surface properties, because we assume that the molecular surface is the important feature that's distinguishing what will be active in against the protein target, or other 3D grid mapping methods. Now, on the other hand, what the docking approach is doing is that, first of all, we start out with a protein structure. So what we heard before, that so there is behind this little stick representation, that's the actual structure of the protein, which we heard how difficult to find out from distances and crystal structures. But once we have it, and we trust the people who produce those data that we have these 3D structures, then basically the function of the protein is typically determined by a pocket, a cavity, which is the sort of active site where binding occurs. And what we are looking for is small molecules that can bind into that pocket. So we have all these different ligands that are available in the database, and we have to go through them and have to try to fit them into this pocket to find the right conformation and the right orientation to place them there. And such way that the interactions between the ligand and the receptor site will be favorable. And we need to estimate the binding energy, binding free energy, and then output the best conformation and pose that we found. Now, for this problem, there are lots of algorithms available, and I'm not even attempting to list them all. This is just a very small sampling. I recently came across a review paper that listed 60 of them, and I don't think even that was comprehensive. So there are a lot of them out there in different ways. I just tried to put together this slide, sort of categorizing the different ways of going about how to place these small molecule ligands into these active sites. So there are two major categories in my mind. There are methods which work in a kind of trial and error way, and there are systematic methods. The trial and error can be further subdivided, whether it's working with single structure at a time, like a taboo search, or the Monte Carlo simulated annealing, or multiple structures like genetic algorithm or simulated population annealing. And systematic methods could work with the incremental construction, piecing together the structures, or sort of global fitting method. And then there are different techniques, again, click detections, multiple copy rigid dockings, and so on. Yes, that's what I'm going to talk about in detail. That's our algorithm. So, for the e-hits, let me try if that feature works, to keep this content as I go through, and Let's look at, first of all, how to define the problem size. And so what we would like to do is to come up with an exhaustive search. And what is an exhaustive search? Obviously, you want a systematic method with no random elements. Now, just to illustrate what I'm talking about, I use a simple 2D function here with a shape. And let's say we want to find the highest point on this landscape. Obviously, the real problem is much more higher dimensional and much more complex, but this is just to illustrate the idea. So if you do a systematic sampling on this kind of grid, well, that's systematic, all right, but obviously it's not exhaustive, because if you have this type of function, just sampling a few points here is not going to be enough to find your ideal point. So what you need is something much finer sampling. But if you're going to go to that kind of level of sampling, then you will find your right solution. But if you do it for the actual docking problem, then we will see that it's a huge number of sampling that we have to do, and it's just not practical. So what we are really looking for is some sort of intelligent exhaustive search where we can eliminate the majority of the search space and not even bother searching there, and focus on some smaller subregions where there's a hope, and then do a fine sampling on those regions. So that's what we are trying to attempt. Now, first of all, we have to define what type of sampling we can go when we don't do this kind of exhaustive searching. And we recognize that for the interactions between the protein and the ligand, there are some typical interaction types like hydrogen bonds and hydrophobic contacts. And if you look at those, then the definition of what's a typical hydrogen bond, there is some limits on how far the distance can be between the hydrogen and the acceptor. And also for a hydrophobic contact, if you go too close, then it's already clashing. If you go too far, then there is no contact. So there is a certain limit under which you can say that this is an interaction. So in order to be able to catch these interactions, we need to have a resolution that is capable of predicting or checking the atom positions at least half angstrom or closer. So that's a kind of minimum requirement for sampling to be exhaustive, because otherwise we are simply going to miss interactions if we are not going that fine. Now, what that means, this half angstrom sampling, is that it's obviously for translations and rotations we can calculate what it means. The trickiest one is for dihedral and conformational changes. And just to look at an example, a relatively small drug-like molecule can have easily a distance of having a rotatable bond like this one here, where you can fix this end of the molecule, maybe it's making some hydrogen bonds or something, and then you can rotate the other end. And then this fluorine atom could move, because it's 7 angstrom away from this rotation axis, it can move by half an angstrom if you make 5 degrees of modification at this dihedral angle. So because of that, dihedral sampling also has to be about 5 degrees or less if we are starting to sample conformations of the structures. Now, of course, one could say that, okay, why would we bother sampling all these conformations? Because we can just look at low energy conformations and we don't need to bother with all the possible dihedral angles. Now, to answer that question, we looked at statistics on like 5,000 PdV structures that were high resolution, and we looked at how often we see some high energy strained angles. And surprisingly, there are 37% of structures that are very high energy, very much strained structures are visible, like, for example, this is one example showing an almost 0 degree dihedral here, which is extremely strained. But obviously, it's because the environment, due to the binding and the shape constraints, there are lots of constraints. So it's not on its own, this molecule, that it would occupy a low energy conformation, but there is a lot of constraints around that it has to satisfy. So some of the angles might be very much strained. In fact, if we look at sampling of only 60 degrees for each rotatable bond around the ideal, like staggered conformations and so on, then we would miss 97% of the X-ray conformations by more than 5 degree error. And that's the 5 degree error that we decided to allow. So because of those, even not just the highest strain, but everything. Another way of looking at it, if we plot three different dihedrals that are in ligands that are in these structures, then the dihedrals that come out form this, the scatter plot is almost a solid brick, practically every combination up there. So that means it's not just a few spots of the ideal positions, but we really have to sample everything. Now, what does it mean in terms of search space size if we sample everything? If we want to do a translation at half angstroms, rotations at 5 degrees, and dihedrals at 5 degrees, then for a ligand molecule, we end up with assuming a 10 angstrom box within an active site that we want to sample, we end up with a number that is assuming 6 rotatable bonds, it's 10 to the power 20 poses per ligand. That's a big number. If we have a very fast scoring function where we can evaluate 2,000 of these poses per second, it's going to take us 3 billion years to do an exhaustive search. So that's why I said at the beginning that going completely brute force exhaustive is not going to work. So we have to do something smarter. Of course, there are stochastic methods which will search at fine resolution, but they also have to explore this huge space, and obviously within a short limited time, they will only cover a very small, very tiny fraction of the space. And with no driving force towards coverage, how sure you can be that you found the right solution. I just quoted a paper here where basically they compare different scoring functions, and the main conclusion of the paper was that the biggest problem is not so much about the scoring functions being able to recognize the good pose or the X-ray pose, but because the docking programs didn't produce the right pose, or the pose that were produced were far enough that the score is already significantly worse than the actual pose should be. So now, didn't work last time. I don't know if it's there. Okay, going through the actual EHITS algorithm, there will be all these steps that I'm going to go through. So, first an overview of the whole algorithm. The idea is that we are going to use a sort of a divide and conquer algorithm, that we divide up the ligand, that let's say this is an example ligand up here, we divide it up into rigid fragments and connecting flexible chains. So instead of trying to deal with the whole molecule at once, we will start docking these rigid fragments. And all of them, we dock everywhere and try to flood the cavity with all possibilities. And then we try to find from all these different poses compatible ones which can be recombined into a complete solution. And then we feed back the flexible chains after that. And then we do a local energy minimization at the end. So that's the basic idea. Now, how do we fragment the ligand? So ring structures will be all kept as rigid. So from this ligand, we will end up with these fragments noted here. And then every time we break a bond for a flexible chain that comes here, then we duplicate that bond in terms that it's also included in the rigid fragment and included into the flexible chain that we broke up. And so the flexible chains that are in between are basically single bonded with sp3 hybridized atoms typically. Now, how do we solve the simpler problem that we are looking at rigid fragments, that we don't have to worry about conformation, there is no rotatable bond in them, so it's all rigid. Still, we need to do a docking very fast. So to make it faster, we use a simplified model. Instead of worrying about the complete structure, we do a shrink wrap of a polyhedron shape around it. Using regular polyhedron, we just have a certain directions, and then we measure the length from the center of mass of that fragment, and then we come up with this simplified shape instead of the actual shape of the molecule. And then in the simplified shape, these colors represent chemical features. So we kind of label them what type of interactions could happen at those points. And also for the cavity, we represent it by placing on a grid, on a half angstrom grid, some center points, and then we shoot these rays out in every direction, and we measure the space, how much space is in the different directions. And then we have this set of distances from that point. And now we can very rapidly decide where we can fit a rigid fragment because, yes? So basically, we have a regular polyhedron, like, let's say an icosahedron. And then we have the directional vectors of it, and then we just place the center on the center of mass, and then in every direction we shrink it to the actual surface of the molecule. So the different vectors are no longer regular thin lengths, but they are variable lengths. And we represent the whole shape basically with those set of lengths. And then we shrink it down to this actual molecular fragment. And then we just use the vertices of the icosahedron, and we represent it by, we know each vector is a specific vector, and we have the length of that vector. Now, because it's a regular polyhedron, what we can do is the orientations of this fragment can be represented by a permutation vector, permutation table on the vertices, because we will have 60 self-symmetric transformation of the icosahedron. So in those, all of those will define different orientations of the fragment. So, and what it means is that when I ask the question, can I place this fragment into this position, all I have to do is compare those 12 numbers or 20 numbers, the lengths with these, and do it in the 60 different permutations. So I don't have to do any 3D transformation. It's just a simple length comparison on a table. Actually, what we do is we use a combination of icosahedron and dodecahedron. So we have 32 vectors to cover the space a bit more accurately, and because they are inverse maps of each other, so that the vectors are in the middle of the other face, so it's a better coverage, and they have the same 60 self-symmetric transformations. So with that method, we can very quickly find out all the positions and all the orientations where these rigid fragments can fit. Now, once we have the rigid fragments placed everywhere, and typically we end up with a huge number of like 10 to 50,000 of positions for fragments, then what we need to find out is which set of them are compatible. So what we need is, okay, to represent this, what this matrix represents, we define a graph where first, let's say there is 4 fragments in this example in the ligand, and for each fragment we have only 8 poses here. In reality it's much more. This matrix is much bigger. But basically what we say is that these are the poses of the first fragment, and then these are the poses of the second fragment, and so on. And then in this matrix we indicate if 2 fragment poses are compatible with each other with a bit turned on. Compatibility means that those 2 fragments don't bump into each other, and the distance from each other is feasible in terms of what chain has to connect them. So they cannot be too far apart or in a certain position, depending on how long is the chain that has to connect them. So basically we end up with a very sparse matrix here indicating which pairs of positions are compatible. And what we need to find is a click in this matrix, because what we need is one position for every fragment. So we need to find 4 positions basically for the 4 fragments where everything with everything is compatible. Now, of course, using a standard click detection algorithm will work, but since we are talking about a really big matrix in the actual practical problem, it's going to be very slow because the click detection is a slow method. It's exponential in worst case. But we can use a lot of tricks here because we know something special about this matrix. There are these blocks, and we know that within each block there will be only one pose that we are interested in. And also, each block has to have a position. So if we select, let's say, pose number 4 for the run, then it has to have, within each of these other blocks, it has to have a compatibility with another fragment pose. So if we see this part, this section here, that is empty, that means this number 4 pose will never be compatible with any of the poses of another fragment, therefore we cannot use this pose number 4, so we can throw it out. And every time we find an empty section in any of the blocks, horizontal or vertical, we can throw out those poses. So we can do a lot of pre-filtering this way, and then once we've done this pre-filtering, then we can also do this on the fly. So once we start doing the click-detection and we have a partial solution where we selected one or two in the backtrack of the click-detection, then we can do the same filtering that for the remaining task, we can check these sections, and if there is anything empty, then we can again throw out that solution and backtrack and go on. So this speeds up the actual click detection a lot, and we end up with something manageable. But still, for some problems, it could be way too slow. So for that reason, what we do actually in the practical case, that we do a clustering, and we don't do it for all the 50,000, but we only do it for maybe 1,000 posts per ligand. But that means we can lose some solutions that way. So we developed another method where we can do a best matching, which is not an exponential but a linear time algorithm, but it has a drawback. The other one was exhaustive, so we found all solutions. With this method, we have made a certain assumptions on the scoring function, and in addition, we are relying on the scoring function, meaning we will not find every solution, we are just trying to find what's best according to the scoring function. So in this case, what we do is we first build up a tree representation of the structure as these fragments are connected together, and then we will do a requirement, so we score all of these possible poses, so we look at what's the best. And then for everything, we look at what's compatible in the tree structure down, and then we select the best combination score and keep going down in a tree search, basically defining the best K scoring pose sets. And this tree search is, what we are assuming is that the scoring is correct, and what we have decided at some point is really the part of the best solution. And also what we have to assume is that there is no scoring between this structure and this structure, so that there is independence between the fragment scores, which isn't really true because there could be interactions between the fragments. So so that's again a limitation of this algorithm, but on the other hand, this can handle much larger pose sets. Now, once we have decided on the poses of the rigid fragments, then we have to put back the flexible chain. For that, what we do is we use a trick where we try to find an initial conformation using the diamond lattice. The diamond lattice is a nice thing. It's basically carbon atoms arranged in a very symmetrical fashion, forming all these six-membered ring type of things from looking at one direction. And basically what's the property of this diamond lattice is that if you start out from one point and you start walking on the path, every time, every dihedral angle is a 60 or 120 or 180 degrees, so they are all good angles, sort of, so all low energy conformations, gauche interactions or staggered conformations. So basically, if we are hoping for a good conformation, low energy conformation solution for the whole chain, that then there will be something similar to that path in the diamond lattice. So what we do is we place the diamond lattice to the starting point, and then we look up the end points that we are requiring based on the rigid fragment poses in the diamond lattice and try to find the path which has the right number of bonds leading back to the starting point. Yes, so basically the diamond lattice is based on a sort of an average bond length. Usually these atoms are all carbons, because typically when you have heteroatoms, they form some structures that will end up in rigid fragments because they have some double bonds or they have a functionality that will typically break up. So what you have is usually these are all carbon chains. Therefore, the bond length is fairly standardized, so we can use a standard carbon bond length. And they are all sp3, so they are all single bonds, so there is not much variation in the bond length. Yes, so basically what we do actually is that we have our diamond with standard carbon bond length, and we place it down and we do the lookup. But once we selected the pathway, then all we use from the diamond is the dihedral angles, the set of dihedral angles. And we actually apply it to the real chain that is in the input structure with the real atom types and the real bond types and the bond lengths, I mean. So the actual bond lengths and bond angles are preserved from the input structure, and we only modify the dihedrals of it. So we just select the dihedral set from the lattice, and then we apply it to the actual chain, and then that's our starting guess, and then we minimize that. So we do a local minimization after that to try to actually match the endpoints of the other rigid fragments. So once we fitted back these flexible chains, and then we have the rigid fragments, then we can reconstruct the whole structure, and the reconstruction is again done in a pairwise fashion, again, because we don't want to pile up the errors starting from one end, so basically we do always the closest pairs first, and then try to go up in a kind of a tree format to build up the whole structure, and then once we build up the whole structure, then we do a complete local minimization for the entire structure. Now, I'm running out of time, so I'm just going to skip the protonation and the doc table as well. Okay, so the next step is the scoring function, because the whole docking problem is basically two parts. One is how we generate the poses, and then the other one is how we score them, how we decide what's a good pose out of all the millions that we are going to generate. So I'm going to again throw up a similar figure what I did for the docking algorithm. For the scoring functions, also there are lots of different ways of doing it. I would define three different major categories: force field based methods, empirical and knowledge based methods. Let's just look at what my biggest problem with the practically all the scoring functions out there is that practically all of them are atom center based. And typical force field models will place charges and parameters for atoms, which is very nice. But when you look at a situation where, let's say, there is a histidine sidechain, a dimethyl ring with a nitrogen in it, which has a lone pair, and then you look at how it interacts with a water molecule, the hydrogen bonding, and you compare this orientation with the above the plane orientation, then quantum numerical calculation very nicely tells us that there is a significant 4.5 kilocalories per mole energy difference between the two. So this one is favored over that one. But if you use point charge models, atom center models, that's basically equivalent to a good old Bohr model of everything spherically symmetrical and we only care about distance, which is completely opposite to what quantum mechanics tells us, where we talk about electron density and location probability, and it's all about the electrons, and then we suddenly ignore the electrons and their locations, and we just concentrate on atom centers, and we assume a single charge and the radial distribution of the forces. So that's a big problem. How can we solve this? How can we do a scoring function that isn't atom center based? So what we decided in EHITS to do is to use interaction surface points, which is basically a few specific surface points that have special properties or importance. For example, an OH group, we would have the hydrogen direction, obviously that's important, and then the lone pair directions, where the highest electron density occurs. And for a carboxylate group, we would have, again, the lone pair directions of the oxygens, these little cones, and then also above and below the plane, these pi electron directions. Then from these surface points, we can compute interactions, and there will be different types of surface points, just like there are different atom types. So we can talk about different hydrogen bond donors, acceptors, pi, aromatic pi interactions, hydrophobic metallion, whatever. This is how it looks like when we place these surface points, and they all have directionality because they come from the certain heavy atom. So this is how it looks like for the ligand, and this is how it looks like for the cavity side, all these little triangles with directions. How we define the interaction between two of these is that, so we have an interaction here occurring, so there's an interaction distance between the two surface points, and then we have two angles from the direction from the heavy atom to the surface point to this, and then on the other side, and we have a torsional angle because these two may not be coplanar. So with these four parameters, we can describe the interaction. Now, the idea for the scoring function, okay, so we have our definition of geometric definition, how we define an interaction, but how we will associate some energy with it, what is a good interaction, what is a bad interaction. Now, that's where we turn to statistics and we say, okay, let's trust what's in the 3D structures of the proteins. Let's look at them and collect information. And whatever is occurring frequently, we will trust that's a good interaction. And but before we start jumping and using all the information from the PDB, we have to recognize that those 3D coordinates are not facts, they are models with all their errors and problems. So first of all, we have to do some serious filtering and curation. If you look at all the high resolution 2.5 angstrom or better crystal structures, there are about 21,000 with protein ligand complexes. And then if you look at this WattCheck software based on this publication that already checks a lot of different conditions. I'm not going to go through all of these now, but basically there are lots of conditions where you can tell that the model is wrong or there is huge errors in it. And then based on that, it can flag things. So first of all, we do this major flagging and throw out anything that is very suspicious. Then after that, we look at sidechain flags because certain things like histidines and asparagines and glutamines, they could be this way or this way, and the electron density will be almost identical and very hard to tell. So when they actually do the calculation and they decide to put it this way or that way, it could be very arbitrary. And then when you look at the hydrogen bonding possibilities around it, that could decide, okay, it was put in the wrong way, and let's just flip it. So that's something that we can do. And then also there is a electron density server where the actual raw data for the crystal structures is deposited. So we can compare to that and see which of the atoms are actually really there in the electron density that is a good data for, and which ones are just put there because the protein sequence have that atom, so we need that atom, but there was no data for it, so they just modeled it. So that's a big distinction, and obviously we have to look at which atom positions we can trust when we are collecting statistics and which ones are just modeled there, so we don't really know where they are. So with this, we are also flagging atoms that should be ignored during the calculations. After that, we do a statistical data collection where we look at all these 5,000 remaining high-resolution structures that we can trust, which have millions of atom-atom interactions in them. And for each of the atom positions, again, these are models, and these are coming from crystal structures where there is a lot of uncertainty. So what we have is that we have some information about that uncertainty, which is called the temperature factor or B factor, which basically represents a Gaussian distribution that all they know is that, yes, this is the highest probability position where we put it, but it's something that is somewhere around, and some of the atoms are much more certain, and some of the atoms are just somewhere around, and we don't really know. So for this, basically, the probability of an atom at a certain distance can be expressed with a Gaussian from that temperature, using the temperature factor information. And by combining this information for the different atoms that are interacting, we can come up with a simple formula that expresses the probability of a certain distance to occur between them based on their temperature factors, these B1 and B0. Now, similar formula can be cooked up for all these angles and dihedrals that I talked about, all four parameters that we need. And then basically, we can collect the data in a way that we are not just relying on actual 3D positions, but considering the probability distribution of those atoms, so where they really were. And those atoms that were strongly trusted will have a much stronger impact on the statistics. So once we made the statistical collection, just to illustrate what we are getting is, for a given distance between certain atom pairs, we get this type of figures, which is a good news that it's extremely similar to the Van der Waals-Lennard-Jones type of formula. So that's a kind of indication to us that we are in the right track, because we are getting something that other models and energetic models are saying that's the actual shape of things to come. So that also gives us another way of how deep these curves go, gives us an energy estimation based on the Boltzmann distribution. So whatever is more frequently occurring is better in energetic terms. So we will have this big data, but as I told you, we have these four parameters to describe an interaction, and there are lots of different possible pairs of these surface points. So obviously we are going to have a huge distribution data for various different distances when we calculate those integrals. So using all that data is impractical. So what we are going to do is we fit some empirical functions that try to approximate that data. So we go into basically polynomials with some cosines thrown in to represent better the typical shapes of these curves. So in this complete formula, we have a bunch of 20 parameters that we can fit to represent our actual data, the statistical data that we collected on this huge 4D array. And then once we did the fitting, and then we come up with the energies, then we have this matrix of all the different surface point types that we defined against everything, and then the depth of that curve is represented by these numbers. Some of them are negative, some of them are positive. Negative means it's good interaction, positive means it's bad. Now, what's interesting about this approach is that some other scoring functions will talk about, okay, there are charge interactions, there are hydrogen bonds, maybe pi stacking or hydrophobic, and a few, maybe 5, 6, and then that's it. What we have here is a lot more. It's like 24 by 24 matrix. And what that means is that, yes, there are a bunch of different hydrogen bonding types, like these blue ones, and then there are hydrophobic interactions and pi stacking interactions, these areas here, and there are also other interesting things like pi aromatic and cation donor interactions, these purple ones, or metal ion interactions, this line, and there is a lot of others that I don't even have a name for, which are all these white ones. Those are just different type of interactions. Now, the point is that all this is coming from the data what we see in the PDB. So what is good and what is bad is not decided a priori by me or anybody. It's decided by the data. So what we have obtained this way is a statistical way of saying what's a good and what's a bad interaction, but it's only about interactions. But when we are looking at protein ligand binding, there are lots of other things that come into play, not only the interactions. For example, the desolvation, because all these molecules, both the protein and the ligand, are in water in solution, and when they meet together, then some water has to be removed, so there is a desolvation penalty. And then there are also steric clashes, so we don't want to penetrate the protein structure. And then there are some other things like pocket depth and ligand strain energy. And of course, the entropy loss is an important factor as well. So I'm going to skip this one too, because of lack of time, and just want to highlight a little bit about, go back to the ligand-based filtering, because what we had talked about was the docking method, but as I mentioned at the beginning, when we are faced with millions of structures, it's just too slow to start docking all of them, so we need some fast filtering. And what we have come up with is basically an idea that based on the same surface points that we use for docking, we can do a fast ligand-based screening of the ligands as well. Simply counting the different types of surface points that occur on a ligand gives us a very simplified categorization. How many of each type a certain ligand has is a sort of characteristic, a description of that vector. Because what we assume is that different ligands will interact with the protein by the surface interactions. So if we are basing our scoring on these surface points, then the count of them, like how many of different types you have, how many hydrogen bond donors, how many aromatic points, and so on, that should be somehow correlated with the ability of that ligand to act as a good binder for that protein. So if we have similar vectors for different ligands, then those supposed to be similarly active. So that's the whole basic idea. So this way, we can come up with a descriptor, which is very simple, and it's also conformation independent, because the way we generated these surface points, they were all generated based on individual properties of atoms, depending on its hybridization and how many neighbors and what type of neighbors it has. Therefore, it's completely independent of the conformation. So different conformations will result in the same vector. So we have this information, and then what we can do is we can train a neural network using a bunch of active ligands that we know are active, and we may have a bunch of inactive or just decoys randomly picked, and then we can train a neural network to distinguish between these two sets. And then we have this huge ligand database of the many millions, and then we can just run this neural network through and then come up with a number which will give us the probability of something being active, being more similar to the active than the inactive. So basically, again, repeating this, so we have to do once this descriptor creation from the whole database, creating the lasso descriptors, computing the surface point, that only has to be done once for the whole database, and that goes with a speed of a few thousands per minute. And then once we have a problem to work on, we have some actives and inactives, then we train this neural network, which is, again, fairly fast, a few minutes action, and then we can use that neural network file and the big molecular descriptor file that we made for the whole database, and then do a screening very quickly, millions per minute. And just to see what we are getting here is with this descriptor, if you look at the actives and the inactives, basically we see a scatter something like that, where the actives are the red ones and the inactives are the black ones, so that there is a distinction between what's an active and what's an inactive. Here again, basically what I'm showing is the average RMSD of the decoys from this center is much higher than the average RMSD of the actives, and even the maximum RMSD of the actives is mostly below the average RMSD of the decoys. That means this descriptor can really differentiate between actives and decoys. Another way to look at it is whether our descriptor is telling us anything different from the 2D structure of the molecules. And the answer is yes, it's telling us something completely different, because if we plot the 2D similarity or dissimilarity, the Tanimoto index, between a set of structures, and then we plot the RMSD of these ISPT vectors, then you got a scatter plot where no correlation can be seen. So it's telling us something different. That's a good thing. And when we look at how it compares with the enrichment, what we are getting with this neural network technique compared to the dissimilarity, then in this graph what you see is, again, there is a big scatter, only this corner is empty. And that's a good thing again, because what it means is that if something is similar, very similar in 2D, then obviously it will be octave. And that is fine, and there is nothing here, so we are not missing those. But on the other hand, we have things up in this corner which are completely dissimilar in 2D and still octave, and we are able to find them. So that's the so-called scaffold hopping, where a completely different underlying 2D structure may result in the same octivity. And because we are focusing on the surface points and not on the underlying structure, we can still pick up those octaves. So just I'm going to skip on this one. Okay. What's the performance of this algorithm that I talked about, the docking algorithm? Well, there are different steps in the algorithm. First, the rigid docking will give you an RMSD. So these are our RMSD values on this angle for 1500 test cases. And it's the percentage of how many of those cases are under certain RMSD values. So like typical cutoff value that programs are reporting is how many are under 2 angstrom, how many of the structures can be docked under 2 angstrom from the X-ray structure for validation. And but this is plotting it from 0 to 2.5 angstroms. For rigid docking, we reach almost 100% at 1 angstrom. So our rigid docking accuracy is fairly good. And then we do pose matching, where we lose a little bit of accuracy, obviously, because sometimes the closest one is not matching up because of bumping. And then we do an optimization, which improves somewhat. Oh, I forgot the pose matching. So first there is a clustering, and then there is a pose matching when we are losing some accuracy, and then we are improving it back to this yellow-green line, which is the best closest solution that we found. And typically we output 32 solutions from a docking run. And the tough question is which one is the best, and that's where the scoring function comes in. And this is our top ranking, where we think is the best, which is significantly lower performance than the actual closest. So obviously there is work to improve the scoring function further. Okay, scoring, cross-docking, and I'm just going to skip to get forward. Now, the bad news. The scoring function. So what we would like to do, and what we are trying to do, is to estimate the binding energy when we are doing this docking and we generating these poses. So the question is, of course, that there are data available where we have a PDB structure and we have a corresponding measured, experimentally measured binding energy. Can we reproduce that data? Huh? Well, this is how we can do it. Not very good. So this is for, again, about 1,500 PDB complexes. This is the scatter that we get between the experimental measured and the estimated binding energy. So this is not very good. There is some trend, but it's a huge gunshot. Now, it's not just EHITS that is doing so bad. That's my excuse. This is a recent publication from Nicholas Motosier's group, where they compared a number of different scoring functions, and they looked at their performance on 100 different structures, comparing the self-docking pose score compared to the experimental binding energy, and also comparing a conformation assembler, which is usually the tougher problem. And so basically it is doing pretty well. In fact, for conformation assembler, it's doing the best. For self-docking, it's second best. So that just means that basically all the other scoring functions are having problems estimating the binding energy correctly, and nobody is doing phenomenally. But there are good news as well, because it's not only the binding energy that they're interested in. It's more interesting for a screening to be able to differentiate between octaves and inoctaves. So the real question is how it's used, obviously, as I said, that we have a large database of candidates and we are able to pick ligands that could be good candidates for drugs. So that's the important thing. To tell how exactly what is the binding energy is not so important as being able to select the right one. So in that sense, this is just a separation of octaves and inoctaves. We are doing fairly good. This is an actually one of our users at Cambridge reported to us this result. And this is just other enrichment results with the EHIT compared to others. I don't want to spend much time on these. Again, basically, this is another set where once you reach one, that means everything is found. So in top 2% of the tests, in a lot of cases, but top 10%, like almost half of them, you can find every octave. This is again a different data set, and that's industrial test, a Merck comparison of different docking programs, what's the performance on a bunch of different families. So, and then this is again the recovery curve of what percent of the, this is a logarithmic plot, what percent of the database has to be searched to find certain percentage of the octaves. And this is the random line, so if you're just randomly picking, then this is the performance, and then you want to be as high as possible. And then this is the average for these 40 different families in the DOTS data set, and then some of them are looking better, some of them are worse. Specific. Now, as for speed, just a few words. Okay, I left that. Now, the default, that there are different accuracy levels of the program, so you can do different level of sampling, and then different level of sampling result in different speeds, obviously. And then this number 3 is the default case where those accuracy results were reported for. And so it's a few minutes, 2-3 minutes time scale. And we can speed that up with various tricks, like this database and HTS parameter set. And another way we can speed that up is using hardware acceleration, these cell processors that have 8 cores, and each core have a dual pipe parallel vector calculations that add another 8 times factor, so we can get some pretty good performance out of these little chips that were designed for gaming. This is the heart of the PlayStation 3. And this is the kind of performance we are getting with that compared to Intel. So with the PlayStation 3, we can get up to 50 times faster calculation than an Intel processor. So we can use our PlayStations to do some real calculation, real science. QS20 is an IBM machine, which blade, which has 2 of these cell processors. So that's the non-gaming application of the cell processor. Yes. So it basically comes down to the point where you can decide whether you buy one of these QS20 blades or you buy 2 PS3s that gives about the same performance and the car to drive them home. So good, but that's the price comparison. So, but we were given a unit from IBM to test it, so it could do some measurement. Now, just to summarize, basically, so I talked about an exhaustive, highly accurate method of docking, which is deterministic and fully automated. And I mentioned the lasso filter, which is a pre-filter to select from a large set of candidates and very quickly, and we are using a scoring function with some special properties. So, thank you very much.